Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Sport. Jessica Lilly will be back in a couple of weeks. Today, we're exploring an issue that a lot of people have strong feelings about. Breastfeeding. Doctors point to overwhelming evidence that breast milk is superior to formula. But what happens when breastfeeding doesn't go as planned? Here's what one mother says.
I thought it would be this, you know, easy, beautiful thing. And it is a beautiful thing, but often it is not easy.
Sociologist and mother of two, Molly Clever, says she thinks society puts too much pressure on women.
You know, it's breastfeeding. It's your body, and it's your body's ability to feed your child. There's kind of nothing more personal or intimate than that. So being unable to do that has a very kind of deep sense of personal failure to it.
Does society put too much pressure on women?
How do we reconcile what we tell women is the recommendations of what you're supposed to do to keep your child healthy without providing them with any of the support that they need to actually accomplish that?
In this episode, more than a dozen women will share their stories about motherhood, breastfeeding, and society's demands. That's coming up this week, Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board, in for Jessica Lilly, who will be back in a couple of weeks. Today, we're lifting the veil on some of the struggles working moms face in Appalachia. And we'll hear about how complicated breastfeeding can be. But first, a bit of history. Babies have been breastfeeding for most of human history. In the late 1800s, formula was invented, though it didn't become affordable until the 1940s. That's when doctors began pushing formula as the preferred way to feed infants. And breastfeeding rates declined. If you've ever watched the PBS series Call the Midwife, you might recall a scene in season 5 in which a saleswoman from a formula company declares her product superior to breast milk.
Here we have the Marlowe's product. As you can see, the tin is a very convenient size for the kitchen. Now, Marlowe's are the first company to create a whey-based formula.
What's all this?
You have as well.
An exercise on behalf of Marlowe's baby formula. A photograph and free tin of formula for each baby. They're American. It's public relations.
Propaganda more like.
So much easier for baby to digest and enriched with vitamins. Some doctors say formula can make baby more intelligent, more attractive. Can you really afford not to try it?
But then in the 1990s, studies began to show that breast milk is better than formula. It has perfect combinations of proteins, nutrients, and fats that a baby needs. And the chemical makeup of breast milk changes as a baby grows. There are lots of studies that show that breastfeeding can even protect infants from getting sick. Kaylee Littleton is a pediatrician and a lactation consultant in West Virginia.
Babies who are breastfed have less respiratory infections, so that's things like colds, the flu, RSV, less diarrheal illnesses, so less just like stomach bugs and things like that. They have a lower incidence of SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome.
This is why the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that infants be breastfed for the first 6 months of their lives. After 6 months, doctors recommend introducing some solid foods while continuing to breastfeed for a year or longer. The World Health Organization says babies should be breastfed for at least 2 years. There are also studies that show breastfed babies are less likely to get diabetes, heart disease, and even some types of cancer. But it's really not clear whether this is because the babies were breastfed or because of socioeconomic factors. Women with higher incomes are more likely to breastfeed. Turns out, most moms in the United States start out breastfeeding, but many stop as complications arise. In today's episode, we'll hear some of the reasons why this might be. Oh, and because we're quoting a lot of studies and facts in today's show, we decided to make things easier. We've posted a version of today's script online with citations and links. You can find that at wvpublic.org. Now, we're going to meet the youngest person in today's show, 5-week-old Luke Davidson. Now, when we caught up with him, Luke was eating a midday meal. His mother, Lacey Davidson, was breastfeeding him.
Are you ready? Oh, gosh, Anna. Anna. Watch your little hands.
Once he starts eating, Luke calms down. His breathing slowly becomes more regular.
You know, I visualize it, like, moving in through his brain and down his body, and I, like, feel the energy and the nourishment, like, going from me to him. So that's kind of fun. You know, it's not a feeling I ever thought that I would have or anticipated having.
Lacey is on maternity leave. She works full-time for the West Virginia Department of Agriculture and is a yoga instructor part-time. She's taking 12 weeks off, half of which are unpaid. Paid maternity leave is not guaranteed by law in our country. We'll hear more about that in a little bit. After a few minutes of feeding, Luke starts making this sound. Luke briefly lets go of Lacey's breast. She resettles him, and he starts again.
Yeah, so actually on this side, we've struggled with the latch. So a few days ago, it was like excruciatingly painful on this side, no problem on the right. And then I discovered I had mastitis, which was a first for me. My mom was pretty convinced I had it, but of course I didn't believe her.
Mastitis is an infection in the breast, usually caused by backed up milk ducts. The breast can become engorged. It's very painful.
I was convinced I had the flu, and then lo and behold, I had mastitis. So the last couple of days, the milk production slowed down, and today it picked back up. So what's going through my mind now is, like, thank the good Lord. He's able to eat and be fed and satisfied and happy. That was a little nerve-wracking, to say the least.
Mastitis aside, Lacey says breastfeeding is going well. But for many women, it's not easy. Kara Lofton reports on the struggles some women face when breastfeeding doesn't go as planned.
Okay, buddy, do you want to read a book? Let's pick out a book, okay? Yeah.
When Emma Pepper got pregnant, she was totally on board with breastfeeding until her son was born.
He could never quite latch properly, and he was actually born on a weekend in the hospital, and so the lactation consultants weren't available to support me in the very beginning.
Pepper lives in Charleston, West Virginia. We called 14 hospitals in West Virginia, and only two had breastfeeding consultants available around the clock, even though it's common for women to struggle with breastfeeding after giving birth. And unless doctors and nurses have undergone special training, they may not have the expertise to help new moms learn to breastfeed. Only four hospitals in West Virginia require formalized training for nurses and doctors on labor and delivery floors around breastfeeding. These hospitals have a baby-friendly designation from Baby Friendly USA, a World Health Organization and UNICEF program designed to improve the role of maternity services worldwide. The hospital Pepper gave birth at is not one of the four. Pepper says she was told by a nurse to keep her son for more than an hour on each of her breasts to try to get him to latch. So by the time she was discharged from the hospital, she says her nipples were raw.
It ended up making my breastfeeding experience just more challenging overall.
A 2013 study published in the journal Pediatrics found that 60% of women don't breastfeed as long as they intend to. This is because of latching problems, concerns about infant nutrition and weight, the need to return to work, or because they don't have enough support as they try to figure breastfeeding out. Kaylee Littleton is a pediatrician and a board-certified lactation consultant in Weirton, West Virginia. She says a lot of women around here have problems breastfeeding.
Because the information is not great and a lot of the help that women get is not the best for them and things tend to go awry.
Littleton says she hears stories from women about how friends and family, or even doctors and nurses, have encouraged them to supplement with formula just because their baby is big. But supplementing with formula can impact breast milk supply, making it harder to breastfeed. She says many women are also told some pain is normal, but Littleton says it's not, and that pain is a sign of a bad latch. When Pepper was discharged, her son still wasn't latching properly. So the doctor recommended she supplement with formula. Pepper was okay with that, but she still wanted to breastfeed. She worried that if she didn't, her son would be sick more often. In the meantime, she was being urged on by a lot of people. Her friends, her therapist, even her hairdresser asked her if she was breastfeeding.
And so I felt an extreme amount of just societal pressure to be able to live up to that and to and as a result of that, I made some pretty extreme demands on my body in order to be able to fulfill that wish that I had for him.
Pepper says she spent hundreds of dollars on pumps to increase her milk supply. About a week after giving birth, she also connected with a local lactation consultant who suggested a strict regimen: breastfeed, then supplement with formula, then pump to increase milk supply. But Pepper says she was either breastfeeding or pumping around the clock, and it wasn't sustainable.
I felt such an enormous sadness that I was wearing this pump all the time and I couldn't hold and bond with my baby while I was wearing it, and I only had a limited amount of time for maternity leave.
After about 2 months, Pepper would have to return to work. She struggled to breastfeed for 6 weeks. Then the lactation consultant recommended she switch to formula.
Receiving that advice from her was part of what gave me the confidence to go ahead and switch to formula feeding when I felt that I had exhausted every single avenue available to me to make breastfeeding work.
It's a decision she says she wishes she had made earlier. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Carol Lofton.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're exploring the challenges many mothers in Appalachia face when it comes to feeding their infants. We'll also hear from several women who share their thoughts on motherhood. Our producer, Roxy Todd, a brand new mom herself, spoke with lots of women about motherhood.
So, I guess first, before I forget, can you introduce yourself?
Yes, I am Margaret Chapman Pomponio.
When you think of mothers and motherhood, what comes to mind?
Work and love, busyness, strength, beauty, weakness, and power. We definitely put moms on a pedestal, I think. And so there's a lot of judgment about how we parent, the decisions we make about, you know, vaginal birth versus C-section, and do you breastfeed, do you not? I am a parent who struggled for years to have a child. And I just say we struggled with fertility, and we are privileged enough, thank goodness, that we could afford the treatments. When our families knew that we were working on fertility, they wanted to know, you know, they wanted to know the details every step of the way. And honestly, that was okay the first time, but after that that first failed attempt, we just could not handle it as a couple anymore. And we actually said to folks, we may keep trying, but we're not going to let you know. And so it came as a total shock to our families that when I actually was pregnant. Their reactions were hilarious, actually. My mom's first response was, well, if I had known you were having a baby, I wouldn't have gotten this dog. Like, Mom, okay?
Breastfeeding rates are linked to socioeconomic status. Women with low income are less likely to breastfeed. Carol Lofton takes a look at why this disparity exists.
Andrea Reedy is one of 9 children, and her mom, she breastfed all of them. So when Reedy got pregnant, she wanted to breastfeed too.
So it was just kind of something that I knew was there, knew that I was capable of because I had had, you know, kind of that example of.
Reedy says breastfeeding was also the cheapest way to feed her baby. When she got pregnant, she was working as a nursing assistant. But the long hours were tough to handle in the later stages of her pregnancy, so she quit. Her boyfriend is a teacher.
We were just broke. Like, you couldn't afford formula, but we weren't broke enough to, like, have the assistance, like the WIC and that kind of stuff. And so I just kind of knew it was something that I kind of had to do.
Reedy and her boyfriend didn't qualify for WIC, the federally funded supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. WIC subsidizes the cost of formula. But Reedy had a lot of support from her mom and a friend who is a lactation consultant, and she was able to successfully breastfeed her daughter. But for many low-income women, it doesn't turn out that way. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the more money you earn, the more likely you are to breastfeed and to stick with breastfeeding. Stephanie Carroll is the president of the Appalachian Breastfeeding Network.
We do know that those that are lower income have less access to care, less access to support, may have other things going on. There could be some addictions. There could be abuse going on in the family. So it's several things compacting a lower income.
Carol says another barrier for low-income women is the lack of paid maternity leave.
We have a lot of people going back to work early.
And women who qualify for WIC are incentivized to feed their babies formula. To qualify for WIC, a family of three must make less than about $39,000 a year. Carol Peterson is a lactation consultant based in Indiana who helps train new lactation consultants around the country. She's also the former chair of the National WIC Association Breastfeeding Committee.
When it was started, back in the 70s, when we actually had our lowest breastfeeding rates, they didn't recognize human milk as a food. They looked at it as formula, giving people boxes of food.
That thinking has changed in the last few decades at WIC.
They started realizing, well, yes, we're giving formula. Yes, we get rebates from formula. But the optimal nutrition for infants is human milk. So they had to make a big change.
But low-income families had become used to feeding their babies formula. And WIC had developed a reputation as the formula giveaway program. Here in Appalachia, a lot of infants, about half of all the babies born in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Ohio, are supported by WIC, according to federal data. Peterson says WIC is implementing a program that will train staff how to support women with breastfeeding in every WIC office around the country.
Let's say you decided you were going to breastfeed and you don't think it's working, which is 90% of what happens. And it means when you walk in the door, let me take you to somebody to help you resolve those concerns and help you to meet whatever your goals are. And your goals may only be until you go back to work, or your goals may be 6 months or a year. But you need somebody there to give you the information in order to meet those goals and not to just offer you formula.
Peterson says the program should help bridge some of the access to care issues that rural low-income women struggle with. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Carol Lofton.
In the early 1990s, the Family Leave Act was passed. It requires most employers to offer workers 3 months off after the birth of a baby, both men and women. But here's the catch. Employers don't have to pay them for the time off. Also, businesses with less than 50 employees are exempt from the Family Leave Act. So it's legal for small businesses to fire workers if they take time off after a birth. So what all this means is many parents, many mothers, who can't afford to take unpaid time off, return to work soon after having a baby. Now, we don't know when, on average, women in Appalachia return to work. There isn't any research on that. But some breastfeeding advocates say they believe a need to return to work quickly may be one of the reasons women in Appalachia are less likely to breastfeed than women in the nation as a whole. Nearly 900 women answered a West Virginia Public Broadcasting survey about being a working mom in Appalachia. From this, we were able to glean some insight into what working women in our region face, especially when it comes to the challenges of breastfeeding. More than half of the women said they breastfed their babies. More than half also said they received no paid time off work. Returning to work after giving birth can be hard, regardless of how parents choose to feed their babies. Roxy Todd has this story about how it affects moms who breastfeed.
It's a Saturday morning in downtown Charleston, West Virginia. People are queuing up at the coffee shop inside a local bookstore. In a room with free snacks and small chairs, Kat Biller is introducing a storyteller to children for Saturday morning story time.
I think you're all going to enjoy. I personally like the way it's written. I don't know, that style.
Like most hourly workers, Biller didn't get any paid time off after giving birth to her daughter, Jackie.
I went back to work just over a month after I gave birth.
Biller says she would have loved more time off, but she couldn't afford to miss another paycheck. But she says there are benefits to working for a locally owned business. Her bosses encouraged her to bring her infant to work. They provided space for her to feed the baby, change her diaper, and they made sure she didn't work on her own so that she could step away if she needed to. So 4 weeks after giving birth, Biller was back behind the register with her baby sleeping in a sling across her chest. After a month of working with her daughter at the bookstore, Biller asked if she could work evenings and weekends instead of during the day. Her employers agreed. So while she was at work, her husband watched their daughter. He fed her the breast milk Biller pumped at work. Biller says she knows family-friendly work environments like hers are rare.
Were the system as a whole to open up and allow for women everywhere to have even as much opportunity as I had, I think that would be much better.
Biller says she's grateful for the flexibility that her job offers. Still, she says she wishes she would have had a few months paid time off to spend with Jackie. Like Biller, many working mothers return just a few weeks after giving birth. Stephanie Carroll is a lactation consultant in southeastern Ohio.
I've had patients before that, you know, they had the baby on a Friday night and they had to go back to work on Monday morning.
Carroll is the founder of the nonprofit Appalachian Breastfeeding Network, which seeks to increase breastfeeding in Appalachia. She says there's a lot of pressure on women in our region, both cultural and economic, to go back to work early. For many, bottle feeding their babies is a solution to otherwise living in poverty. Pumping breast milk, which can be stored and fed to babies through a bottle, is an option that a lot of the moms we interviewed said they tried. Some had mixed success, and all had conflicting emotions about pumping. Breast pumps cost about $200. The Affordable Care Act of 2010 requires that most health insurance plans cover at least some of the cost. But while pumping enables working moms to feed their babies breast milk, there are drawbacks.
It's very mechanical.
West Virginia State employee Caitlin Ashley Lazarga pumped at work until her son Cillian was 10 months old.
You start to feel like, you know, a drone in a sci-fi movie or a, you know, some post-apocalyptic world.
Lazarga is due to have her second baby in June. We meet at a coffee shop one evening after work, and she tells me she dreads pumping, even though she loves breastfeeding.
For me, at least, it was a connection to my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my great-great-great-grandmother, and all the way back. But pumping takes all, like, strips it all away, and you literally feel like you're just a dairy cow.
Lazarga says she and some coworkers hang a sign of a cow over their cubicles when they pump breast milk. Often they pump right at their cubicle so they can keep working, even though there is a designated pumping space at the office. There's another part of the Affordable Care Act, the break time for nursing mothers, that requires employers with 50 or more workers to offer a room and time for mothers to pump breast milk, and it can't be a bathroom. But employers don't have to pay women for the time they spend pumping, so working moms can lose money or have to stay late to make up the work. That's what happened to Militia.
But honestly, I don't think it's right. I think we should all get paid for it.
We agreed not to use Militia's last name because she's worried her employer might fire her for talking to a reporter. She says she had to clock out whenever she took a break to pump.
Financially, I mean, I made like probably $150 less on each paycheck because I was pumping. And a lot of people can't do it financially.
Militia works at a call center, and sometimes calls went on so long that she went without pumping.
So sometimes you just sit there and you'd be miserable, and that was terrible.
Not only is this uncomfortable, it can cause an inflammation of the breast, called mastitis. Also, because milk works on a supply and demand system, if women skip a feeding or a pump break, they can lose or weaken their supply of milk, especially in the first few weeks after giving birth. Dr. Kaylee Littleton is a pediatrician and a lactation consultant.
Stress itself does not decrease your milk supply, but what it does is alter your feeding and your pumping behavior so that you do things like skip a feed, skip a pump, push things off longer, so that over time that's what actually decreases your milk supply.
Littleton says the best way to maintain a supply of milk after returning to work is to pump regularly, every few hours.
I mean, it's easy for me to say because I was in a job where it was respected and honored.
But she says for women who work in restaurants or gas stations or other jobs with hourly pay, it's not as easy to take a break every few hours.
They probably would just fire you.
She says she hears this all the time.
People say, I don't think my job will let me do it. I write letters for moms all the time saying that they are legally required to allow this. I don't know how effective all of that is, but sometimes it works.
Even salaried employees struggle to juggle regular pumping schedules. And still, 9 years after the break time for nursing mothers became federal law, not all employers offer women a place to pump milk. Kindergarten teacher Angela Burkhart says during her work training, she couldn't find anywhere to pump.
So I had to leave during the morning to go pump. I would pump on my way there. At lunch, I would pump, and then I would pump on my way back. And every time I pumped, basically, in those 3 days, was in my car.
These trainings were held at a local high school. She says she felt reluctant to ask for a special room to pump, especially for a training that only lasted a few days. And she says her boss was usually accommodating, and she felt lucky. At school, she's given both time and a room to pump, although the janitor has walked in on her.
At least a dozen times that year he walked in, like, just absentmindedly.
Still, she says she considers her situation better than what a lot of women face at work. There have been some lawsuits across the country for breastfeeding discrimination. In February, a woman in Delaware won a $1.5 million lawsuit against Kentucky Fried Chicken for not being given an adequate place to pump breast milk. Of the women who answered our survey, nearly 4 out of 10 said they didn't feel like they had the flexibility to pump milk after they returned to work. Molly Clever is an associate professor of sociology at Wesleyan College in Buchanan, West Virginia. She says she was also pretty lucky.
In terms of having paid maternity leave and having a very flexible job and having an office with a door that closes and a refrigerator in my office, that I'm able to pump at work and I'm able to I kind of have that support in my work environment, and I still struggle to do it. So how do women who don't have that kind of job flexibility and don't have that kind of paid maternity leave, how do they do it?
This lack of support in the workplace may be one reason why so many women stop breastfeeding earlier than they intended. The Centers for Disease Control released a report last year that said most mothers in the United States want to breastfeed and start out doing so. But after 3 months, those numbers begin to decline, and only a third continue to breastfeed for a year, which is what the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends for all infants.
How do we reconcile the what we tell women is the recommendations of what you're supposed to do to keep your child healthy without providing them with any of the support that they need to actually accomplish that?
And without that support, breastfeeding becomes even more challenging. And many women, including Clever, say they are left feeling guilty when things do not go as planned. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
So as we've been hearing, pediatricians recommend breastfeeding babies for at least a year. And breastfeeding has benefits for mothers, too. Long-term, mothers who breastfeed have a decreased risk of developing breast cancer. They also have better heart health. Some studies have even shown that moms who breastfeed have a lower chance of developing postpartum depression. But all of this can also put pressure on women, and breastfeeding is tough. A majority of women we surveyed who had tried breastfeeding faced some type of obstacle along the way, and that made a lot of women feel guilty. Here are some of their stories.
I felt guilty leaving my job because I work as a team, and all my other coworkers are male. I then know how to explain to them that I was leaving to stay at home with my son so I could breastfeed him.
You know, I would get comments from every single side about what I should and shouldn't be doing for her, especially around feeding. That was, I'd have strangers come up to me and ask if I was breastfeeding or brag about how long they had been breastfeeding, which I feel like they totally missed the point on that one.
My son had a very bad latch, and it was painful as all get out. I thought it would be this, you know, easy, beautiful thing. And it is a beautiful thing, but often it is not easy.
About 2 months in, I gave up. I was physically and emotionally exhausted. I had postpartum depression, and I know that the pressure from, like, this breastfeeding and the stress that I felt from trying to make it work was certainly a contributing factor in at least not making my postpartum depression any easier to deal with.
I came to a moment of realizing I actually hate breastfeeding. I really don't like it. In terms of bonding with your child, I wasn't bonding with my child. I resented her, you know, that she constantly needed to eat, that I never got a chance to take a break or rest, that I never got a chance to leave the house or be away from her. And I started asking myself, like, what if I stop breastfeeding, not because I can't, but because I just don't want to? And that was a whole new level of, like, mom guilt of, you know, you're supposed to want to. You're supposed to be bonding. You're supposed to have these warm, fuzzy feelings around it, you know. But really, I just kind of hated it.
I really cannot stress enough the amount of pressure that I felt that in order to be a good mother to my son, that I have to breastfeed him.
Breastfeeding is talked about in terms of success and failure. You know, it's breastfeeding. It's your body and it's your body's ability to feed your child. There's kind of nothing more personal or intimate than that. So being unable to do that has a very kind of deep sense of personal failure to it.
We're going to take a quick break. Just ahead, did you know that there are milk banks that collect breast milk to feed premature infants in hospitals? And postpartum depression is fairly common for moms, so why is there so little support? You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. 3 years ago, here on Inside Appalachia, we heard a baby being born.
Push, 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 push.
There we go.
He's coming, babe. Push.
There we go.
If you'd like to go back and listen to that episode called Hippies, Home Birth, and the History of Birthing Babies in Appalachia, we've posted a link on wvpublic.org. Today, we're turning to the next chapter, the first few weeks and months after giving birth. I speak from experience when I say there is no manual on breastfeeding. I was shocked by how little I knew when I started and how much there was to know. Like, did you know that when a baby nurses on one side, the other side leaks? Or that some nursing women's breasts will ache if they hear a crying baby? Any crying baby. Oh, and breastfeeding hurts so much. I would break into a cold sweat bracing myself for each latch. Thank God for lanolin. Lanolin, by the way, is this miraculous healing grease that sheep secrete. Moms put it on their nipples to help with soreness. Even with the lanolin, though, I may not have kept breastfeeding.
But my mom told me, get through the first month and you'll be fine. She was right. After the first month, it didn't hurt anymore. It was smooth sailing. Well, until one breast completely stopped working. That's a whole other story. So yeah, even moms who've had success breastfeeding agree, breastfeeding takes work and some sacrifices, but it can also bring a lot of joy. This is 8-month-old Stella Fallon. She's making a few happy sounds because it's time to eat. Her mom brings Stella up to her breast to nurse her. Stella's mom, Katie Fallon, is a self-employed writer, so she has no paid time off work. She was back to writing a couple weeks after giving birth, and she started teaching at West Virginia University when Stella was 4 months old. Katie travels for her work, and she almost always brings Stella.
Stella has been to a few conferences where she's nursed. We nurse in restaurants. We nurse in bars. Yeah, we've nursed at Lowe's. We've nursed at Target. We nursed at SeaWorld. Pretty much anywhere Stella wants to nurse. We nurse, right, baby?
The CDC reports that more people are comfortable with women breastfeeding in public than they were, say, 20 years ago. But not everyone has the flexibility or the ability to breastfeed. In some cultures around the world, milk sharing is a socially accepted practice among sisters, say, and close friends. And it's something that happens in America, too. Okay, I have a weird confession to make. Several years ago, I was still breastfeeding my baby boy when my sister gave birth to twins. Newborn twins are a lot. So I went to spend some time with her to help out. It was the middle of the night. She was finally getting some sleep. One of the twins was up and hungry. Now, I've never told her about this, so please, if you know my sister, don't mention it. But I breastfed that baby. In that moment, it just seemed like what I needed to do. But as I learned from this next story, milk sharing isn't always safe. In 2017, the American Academy of Pediatricians issued a recommendation that at-risk premature babies be fed donated, pasteurized breast milk if their mothers aren't able to breastfeed. The milk comes from milk banks certified by the Human Milk Banking Association of North America. Donors are tested for contagious diseases. But informal systems of milk sharing exist too, and they could be putting some babies at risk. Roxy Todd explains.
Catherine Ellis had fostered several children, but bringing a 10-day-old baby home from the hospital was an entirely different experience.
He was a safe haven baby, so he had been left in a hospital.
He was tiny.
At birth, baby Cooper weighed just 6 pounds, and he had a pretty serious health condition. He needed multiple surgeries after he was born because the right side of his heart wasn't fully developed.
The doctors even said to us before we took him home, you don't have to take him. You can wait or, you know, wait for a perfect baby or something. And that was just not at all what I thought. My thought was, of course I'm going to take him home with me and I'm going to take care of him.
So when he was 10 days old, Ellis took Cooper home and started the process to adopt him. Like any baby, he needed around-the-clock feedings.
I loved sitting just with him, and we'd sit up on the loft, and the stove would be hot and in a fire, and the heat would go up to that loft, and it would be quiet and dark, and I could look out the window and see snow and feel warm with him, and just, I felt like that time was so special to be just the two of us.
Since Ellis wasn't his biological mother, she fed him formula. The doctors told Ellis that because of his condition, Cooper was vulnerable to viruses and infections. Ellis had heard about scientific studies that show that breast milk has immune-boosting properties, and that babies who drink breast milk have a better defense against viral infections, like the flu and common cold, so she wanted to feed him breast milk. Most of these studies were done in the 1990s, and they led the American Academy of Pediatrics to recommend that all babies be breastfed. But since Ellis didn't have her own breast milk, she decided to feed him donated milk.
I seem to remember it coming in a cooler and just packed with ice.
The women who supplied the milk didn't know each other, but they did have one person in common. A local midwife named Angie Nixon had helped them deliver their babies. She reached out to each of them to ask if they would donate their extra milk. Nixon usually made the deliveries.
All babies should have breast milk. And so when we were looking at the situation and understanding that there was this baby in need, that was my first thought, too, of like, oh, my gosh, it would be great if we could somehow give him the opportunity to have some breast milk.
In this case, Nixon had seen the women's medical histories, and they didn't pass on any infectious diseases to baby Cooper. But this type of milk sharing is risky. The American Academy of Pediatrics warns that feeding babies donated milk in this way is not safe. They recommend that milk banks require blood tests from all donors and that they pasteurize human milk. There are health risks, like bacterial contamination, and life-threatening diseases, like HIV or hepatitis C, can be transferred through milk. Pasteurization kills those viruses and bacterial contamination. Catherine Ellis says she knew the risks, but she trusted that it would be okay. Also, the experience made her feel she had this support from her community, even from women she didn't know.
And for me to be giving him nourishment, which I knew was my job, but to know that there were other moms that had contributed to that, I did feel a support of people that didn't even know us.
Feeling a part of a supportive community is something expressed by several other women we contacted for this story who donated or used donated milk through Facebook or other social media groups online. Several women said they felt like milk sharing connects them to their Appalachian culture, of their mothers and grandmothers, a culture that believes in the value of leaning on your neighbors or family for help. But this culture of sharing doesn't protect against contagious diseases, especially in a region where HIV and hepatitis C is now on the rise. Dr. Stefan Maxwell is the medical director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at CIMC Women's and Children's Hospital in Charleston, West Virginia. He warns against feeding babies donated milk from the internet.
And in this day and age where there's a high prevalence of hepatitis C, HIV, and some of these other transmissible viruses, it's probably not a good idea to use someone else's breast milk unless you know that, unless they've been tested.
Dr. Maxwell does support the use of donated milk when it is tested and pasteurized. He encouraged his hospital to be among the first in the country to feed donated milk to the most at-risk premature babies. The milk they use comes from a milk bank that is certified safe by the Human Milk Banking Association of North America, also known as HMBANA. Naomi Baryam is the former president of HMBANA. She also directs a milk bank in Massachusetts. She says HMBANA requires that all donors be screened to ensure the breast milk is safe and free of diseases.
And we test moms for HIV, HTLV, hepatitis B and C, and syphilis.
Baryam says last year they had to turn down more than 20% of the women who applied to donate because they didn't pass the screening. Still, thousands of women do successfully donate to HMBANA milk banks, and the numbers are increasing. Most are moms who have surplus breast milk. Some are moms whose babies died.
And they are, I mean, they're saving lives, and they talk about it in terms of this is something my baby and I can do to help others.
Baryam says research shows that when NICUs begin using donated milk, more moms actually make the choice to start breastfeeding their own babies. That's what happened at Dr. Maxwell's hospital when they began using donated breast milk 3 years ago.
Well, initially I thought we would have a negative response by the parents, but in fact it's been a very positive response. And in fact we've had the unintended consequence where mothers who had not intended to breastfeed before now decided that they wanted to use their own breast milk.
And Maxwell sees this as the ultimate goal, that more women who are healthy are encouraged to give breastfeeding a try. Because even though donated milk is better than formula, what gives babies the best chance of surviving and thriving is almost always their own mother's milk. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
A study published in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics ran some tests on human milk purchased over the internet. And yes, websites exist that sell breast milk, though it's not legal. The study found that most of the milk was contaminated with bacteria. Now, some types of bacteria are safe, even beneficial, but other types are dangerous for infants. And the researchers found a lot of the dangerous kinds in the donated breast milk, likely from poor pumping, storage, or shipping practices.
My name is Brittany Morgan. So what, when you think, when you hear the word mom or mother, what do you think of?
Well, to me, it's, I'm a supporter of my children, and I'm supposed to do what I have to do to help them. So that's what I think of.
Do you feel like it's challenging to be a mom and juggle all the other stuff in life?
I do. You go to work, you come home, you have to, you know, kids are in school, you have to come home, do their homework with them before you do any of your stuff. You cook dinner, do the dishes, clean up for them, get them ready for bed. It's a lot to juggle, but stuff like that, I feel that a mom that's her job. You know, she cleans up the kitchen, and that's just something that we have to do, and that's a full-time job in itself, coming home after work and cleaning. So,
do you feel like moms get enough respect for that kind of extra work they do?
I don't. I feel like people overlook that, you know, we go to work and then we come home and we have to do more work on top of the work that we've put in all day. And I don't feel like moms get enough respect for that.
Today, the majority of women in America work outside the home, including women who've recently given birth. At the same time, researchers have found that women today actually spend more time with their children than they did in the 1960s. Associate Professor of Sociology at West Virginia Wesleyan College, Molly Clever, herself a mother of two kids, teaches a course on gender studies. She says academics have a term for this.
Sociologists use the term the ideology of intensive motherhood. This is basically, since the 1980s or so, we have this cultural idea that first ties women to motherhood, that says women are supposed to be mothers and supposed to want to be mothers. And then an ideal of motherhood that says that to have high status as a mother, to be considered a good mother culturally, means investing your whole self into it. This idea of intensive motherhood, that you have to be with your children all the time, that you have to cultivate their upbringing, and that your status as a mother is tied to how much you sacrifice of yourself to raise your children. So it's basically, the more exhausted you are, the more sleep deprived and time deprived and stressed out you are, the better you're seen as a mother, and the better you are able to see yourself as a mother. And these are very kind of incompatible things, to be both a good mother and an exhausted and stressed out mother. And the interesting thing about that is that ideology kind of arose more in the 1980s and 1990s as sort of a reaction to women spending more time in the paid labor force and less time at home.
Again, that was Molly Clever, Associate Professor of Sociology at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Throughout this episode, we've heard from dozens of women. Several have shared breastfeeding experiences. A few have talked about how society treats mothers. Then there's the way society treats women who want to skip having children altogether.
My name is Amanda Jane Miller.
I don't want kids, and I'm 35, so I'm super into not having kids right now because I have to talk about it all the time.
What, a woman without kids, what is she doing? It freaks people out.
I thought maybe that when I met somebody I really loved, it would blossom because everyone around me said it would. Maybe it's just shit. It's like, I don't know. I've been trying to force myself to want a kid to feel more like a woman and more like a compassionate human because society just makes you feel like there is something missing in you and you're not a nurturing person. I think that my stumbling over my words is just indicative of, like, I'm so afraid to say the wrong thing and be the wrong kind of woman and be, you know, anti-mom. It's the worst thing you can be. It's worse than being anti-teacher, anti-mom. It's this obsession with, are you going to have kids and are you going to be a mom and are you, have you reached full womanhood because you're a mother yet? It just totally negates a lot of the fatherhood aspect, too. I would really like to be arguing about paternity leave in America versus this conversation we're having. That's kind of what I mean by why are we even talking about it? Who cares? Nobody cares that I don't want to have kids. They shouldn't, but they do.
Now, for our final story, we're going to turn to an issue that is way too common and not talked about enough. Postpartum depression and anxiety. Motherhood is often portrayed as a time when women are glowing with warmth, love, happiness. The reality is, sleep deprivation coupled with the stress of taking care of a brand new human being is exhausting. Add to that a rocky hormonal shift, and you have all the ingredients for a mental health disaster. Carol often brings us this story of several women's struggles with maternal mental health.
Okay. Micaiah, take your showing off level and turn it down to a 1.
Jennifer Petrosky is a therapist and also has 2 young children. I caught up with her the week before she and her husband were set to move to Ohio.
I have struggled with anxiety and depression for as long as I can remember. Even as a child, I struggled with that sort of thing. And what I have learned about maternal mental health, being a therapist and just being a mom, is that it is not discussed until after the baby is born.
Even then, she says, her doctor just asked her point blank if she was suicidal. She wasn't, and left it at that. She was able to cope until she got pregnant again.
When I got pregnant with my daughter, my dad had passed away about 2 months before that. We had had a miscarriage. My husband had chronic fatigue and couldn't get out of bed most of the winter. I know stress played a big role, but every day I just cried in the shower because I was so anxious and so depressed, and I just was like, there's no village around me to help.
Michelle Comer is the West Virginia Support Coordinator for Postpartum Support International and a therapist specializing in maternal mental health.
The way that we live, the way that our society, the trends in our current society definitely compound or magnify the experience of postpartum depression. You know, it isn't new. It's been around as long as moms have been having babies.
Comer says that one of the biggest things that can help moms who are feeling anxious, depressed, and alone is to connect with others who are in the same boat.
We were never intended to parent in isolation.
And yet, many women find themselves asked to be supermom, to be everything for everyone, and to do it by themselves.
And a lot of people say, oh, well, I live around a lot of people, or, oh, I go to church, and they're really nice, but that's not people living with you.
Danielle Burgum has a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. But when she got pregnant the first time, it wasn't planned, and she didn't want to be pregnant. The rolling emotions led to severe prenatal depression and a lingering sense of isolation.
Historical tribal culture, the only thing that they were doing was survival. They had help just with basic survival needs. And we are expected to not only do our basic survival stuff on our own. We're expected to do everything we put on top of that on our own just to function in this culture that we've created. So part of it is this perspective that we have on what being successful is and what you're supposed to do as a mom, as a dad.
Burgum ended up becoming a doula and a birth educator. She focused on her nutrition and completely shifted her lifestyle so that she felt balanced again, which for her meant finding a job she could do from home and homeschooling her kids. It was a long process. For others, like Sarah Doonesbury, though, feeling normal again may involve medication.
After I had my second child 5 years later, it was just like the same thing repeated itself. And that's when I kind of realized that you know, something was wrong, but I was too ashamed because it's not talked about enough.
Dusenberry didn't get help until after the birth of her third child, despite the fact that feelings of anxiety and depression lingered for months, then years after each birth. Now that she's on medication for her anxiety and depression, she says she feels like a whole new person. For all three women, and probably many of the moms in your life, the biggest theme is the need for support and the desire for a return to some kind of village where the burden and joys of raising children can be shared. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Carol Lofton.
Unpaid maternity leave, breastfeeding challenges, social pressures. I really wish we could solve these issues here in this episode. But as I was reminded, we're journalists, not superheroes. Still, I want to share one other personal experience that has shaped how I approach these kinds of things. My little guy was probably a month old when I got a message from another mom I knew. I didn't know her well, so it really surprised me. She told me about how after she first had a baby, she felt depressed, isolated, even trapped, but that it passed. She told me about how hard it was to breastfeed at first, but then things got easier. She said I could call her if I needed to. I cannot tell you how much that note meant to me. I was living in rural Preston County at the time and struggling with so many emotions. Worried about having to return to work in a few short weeks, frustrated that I couldn't slow time, as crazy as that might sound. But that note made me suddenly feel like I was part of the mom club. Everywhere I looked, there were other members, and they had my back. A few years later, an acquaintance of mine had a baby. I sent her a very similar note. So, till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Jessica Lilly will be back in a couple of weeks. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Appalachia Health News and PBS's Call the Midwife. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Matt Jackford, Marisa Anderson, Spencer Elliott, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our fabulous producer. Eric Douglas is our rocking associate producer. Our executive producer is the ineffable Jesse Wright. Ibi Caputo edited our show this week. Bless her soul. Our undaunted audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Couldn't do promotions without Xander Alloy. Tweet at us on Twitter at Inside Appalachia. We love that. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter, which is super cool. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or just look for the Inside Appalachia podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.